Hello and welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsell, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. Throughout this series, created in partnership with Coutts, I will be speaking to senior experts, thought leaders, and influencers from the world of travel, architecture, investment, consumer goods, and more, as we examine how we can embed purpose and sustainability into our everyday lives. From responsible investment to electric vehicles to eco-conservation, we'll explore the new technology, partnerships, and initiatives helping us all to lead cleaner and greener lives. My guest today is the award-winning chef and author, Skye Gingell. Originally from Australia, Skye trained in Paris and has worked at iconic London institutions, including the French House and the Dorchester. As head chef of Petersham Nursery's Cafe, Skye became renowned for her seasonal, elegant cooking, creating dishes inspired by what she saw growing and flowering around her. In 2011, under Skye's leadership, Petersham Nursery's Cafe was awarded a Michelin star. In 2014, Skye opened her restaurant Spring, based in Somerset House. Spring encompasses Skye's signature style of cooking with economy and grace. The menu is filled with delicious, nutritious meals created with ingredients that are often overlooked, from beetroot tops and potato skins turned into soups to yesterday's bread transformed into a warm bread pudding. Alongside Spring, Skye is culinary director for luxury Hampshire hotel Heckfield Place. She was the Independent on Sunday's food writer for 5 years and has published 4 books. In 2019, she was Square Meal's Female Chef of the Year and was also named a Sustainability Champion at the London Restaurant Festival Awards. Welcome, Skye.
Hello.
So, Skye, you were brought up in Sydney and Australia. How did that inform your approach to food?
First of all, I was brought up in a family that was macrobiotic. So I think food was always incredibly important from a health point of view in my family. But actually, it wasn't delicious. So there was a huge emphasis on the nutritional value of food, but not so much emphasis on really what it tasted like. So I think actually that really impacted me in 2 ways. One, that I sought out delicious food when I was away from the home. But also, I think as I've gotten older, I've realized how those principles, the really kind of authentic principles of macrobiotic cooking, which is a lot of it is seasonality and eating within a small radius, has impacted me, I think, very subconsciously, actually, because I think I rebelled against it as opposed to embraced it when I was young. But apart from that, I grew up in I think the whole kind of Sydney lifestyle, it's very multicultural. It's a real melting pot of food, Australia, because a lot of people who immigrated to Australia had very strong food cultures, the Italians, the Greeks, the Lebanese, the Vietnamese, the Chinese. And there's a huge culture of eating out in Australia, and there always has been. Lots of people go out to dinner 3 or 4 nights a week. It's cheap. There's lots of hole in the walls. And so growing up, and certainly in my teenage years, or when I earned a little bit of money from a first job and things, we would go out a lot when we were young. It was very much part of our kind of social life, was going out and eating.
So you then developed this kind of produce-first, seasonal and sustainable approach to cooking that's now very popular amongst UK chefs, but you were really one of the first to champion this approach. I mean, first at Petersham Nurseries and then at Spring. What inspired you to approach your food in that way? And what was the reception like at the time that you pioneered it?
Well, I think with Petersham, we had a very small vegetable garden. And the vegetable garden actually was established in the main house when I first came to cook at the nursery. And the idea for the restaurant at the nursery was a sort of a real add-on. I mean, the nursery had been bought by the owners. It was at the end of their garden. Garden centres don't really make any money, but you can have a cafe without a restaurant license in all garden centres in England. So they came to me and I thought that I was going to go down there and literally cook for one summer. And then, because it's not on the A to Z, it was so sleepy, and I just couldn't really imagine But I was so compelled because they had this tiny, very well-established vegetable garden. And I think I used to go there very early in the morning and I'd sit in the vegetable garden and write the prep list. And when you really plant your feet in the soil and you see what's growing around you, it feels completely unimaginable to cook with food that's not actually in season and good right now. So I think it probably started from that very small vegetable garden, and it's definitely expanded. I mean, the vegetable garden at Petersham was always, it was never enough to kind of supply the whole restaurant, but we'd get our quinces and our apples and we'd have rocket growing, some artichokes and different things. But it wasn't really until I opened the spring and I established my relationship with Jane Scotter from Fern Farrow that I think I began to encompass all the things. I really saw how a real farm worked. And I saw the kind of gluts, the feasts and the famine in a much larger scale. And that's where the kind of food waste and all the other issues that we deal with at Spring sort of came from.
So I'm going to return later on to your sourcing strategy, but I want to ask you, you're not just a chef, you're also a food writer. You've authored cookbooks, you write regularly, and you're an editor in relation to food. Does that process of writing about food influence your work as a chef?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I remember when I was asked to write my first book and I had no confidence, or I hadn't developed a voice. And I remember I was very nervous and very reticent to write a book originally. And I actually was speaking to Nigel Slater one day, and I think he's one of the greatest writers on food. He's so emotive. The way he writes is so emotive around food, and I really admire him. And he said to me, just start writing and you'll find your voice. So as I began to write, I did sort of find a voice. But also, I think it was a wonderful experience for me to write because it really makes me think and understand what I really do feel about food in a more literal rather than just a sort of feeling way, because I connect to food in a very emotional and visceral way. And it was quite nice to kind of join the dots between my head and my heart. And I think writing helped me do that.
So speaking about emotional and visceral, tell us, what is your least favorite food trend and what is your favorite food trend?
I really almost balk at just the word trend. Because I think I've been around food I've been working in food for 38 years. So I think it's probably like fashion. You see things come and go. And what I have really enjoyed, I'll be really honest, and I'm really hesitant to be critical about anybody because I think everybody works really hard and it's genuinely sort of trying to do their very best and find their own voices. And I don't think it's for me to kind of criticize what anybody else is doing, but I do have really enjoyed the opening up of the food scene in England over the last 5 or 6 years. And what I have seen from when I really started cooking was when I first came to London to live in sort of 1985, there was a very, very sparse dining scene. So there was kind of the Michelin stars and the kind of hotel restaurants. And then there was sort of Pizza Express. And there was very little in between, you know. And it was always considered if you wanted to go into cooking that it had to be a sort of very traditional, very hierarchical way of working. And it took so long. You started as commies and, you know, it was all sort of like very kind of like, they were quite hard places to work, kitchens, and the structure could be quite limiting for some people and very good for others. But I've really, really loved seeing the kind of emergence of lots of young people like expressing themselves and the kind of rise of lots of little restaurants. And just, I think it's become a very exciting, very inclusive dining scene in England or the UK.
So you spoke about what it was like at Petersham to go to the small vegetable garden and harvest things that were fresh and still literally in the ground. What advice would you give to someone who's looking to replicate that kind of local and seasonal approach to food at their home, and particularly to those people who may not have access to outdoor space?
Gosh, I mean, I live in a very urban way, in a kind of very small house with an absolutely kind of postage stamp sort of back garden, really. But I still find sort of room to kind of have all my herbs in pots. And I mean, this year I've grown strawberries and artichokes and tomatoes and all the kind of herbs. So I think you can grow beautiful things in very small spaces. What I've been amazed about is how abundant the earth is. I mean, in a very small patch of land, if it's well managed, if it's truly biodiverse, can feed so many people. So I think you can, even on a windowsill, you can kind of plant some rocket or some basil or mint or some little things that just kind of give you some pleasure when you actually sort of like pick it and scatter it on top of your food. But the other thing is, I would say that sort of begin to kind of maybe visit farmers markets or places where you can actually have a kind of dialogue with the person selling your food, and that person understands where that food has come from, as opposed to kind of maybe shopping in a more impersonal and kind of in a kind of big consumeristic sort of way. And I'd also maybe suggest the most important and the most enjoyable things I do is I shop little and often. So I will often just buy a tomato and a piece of cheese and some bread to eat for dinner. I don't do kind of big shops. I kind of think about what I'm feeling like eating. I mean, I don't have children at home anymore, so I do understand the challenge of kind of fueling the family. But I think you've got to enjoy the experience of shopping. And I think the way we shop now is not particularly enjoyable. And I think if you do kind of go find a small farmer's market where you live, I think there is a kind of huge enjoyment and community to shopping like that. And I think that probably kind of lights the flame a little bit and gets you a little bit excited about what you've bought and then in terms of what you you want to do with it.
I want to ask you a question about food waste, because it's been a thing that you have been sort of very focused and attentive to in your career.
Mm.
By some estimates, UK households waste 4.5 million tons of food a year, which seems to me just to be extraordinary. And so as a chef, what practical tips could you give to people who are seeking to minimize and avoid food waste?
Well, I mean, we have really sort of embarked on it as a project, I think. And it really came about because we were working with Fern Vero, which is Jane Scott's farm in Herefordshire. And if you do really work with a farm, unfortunately, you know, it's prey to so many things, all best laid plans, and then kind of nature gets in the way. And the other thing is about farms is it's feast or famine. So you don't wake up in the morning and say, oh, I'd like 20 courgettes today. You may have 1,000 courgettes, or you may have had a really sort of wet spring and the soft fruit is really not good this year, or a really hot spring and you have an abundance of fruit that you don't know what to do with. So it is really, you're really sort of, you have to learn to sort of be very fluid in the way you cook. But what really happened with us was Jane has a very small, beautiful plot of land, 16 hectares, and it is incredibly abundant. And we found that I made a commitment to her when we started working together that if she could grow things for us, I would take them. I really wanted to prove that a restaurant could sustain a small farm, because it's very hard for small farms. You know, they're great at growing, but they're not necessarily great at transport or marketing or so I just wanted to prove as a kind of work relationship that it actually could be fruitful. But what happened was there was just all this stuff came flying at us, you know, at times, sometimes not the best times of the year. And so we thought about I guess it must have been how people used to, you know, nothing used to be wasted, as you probably know, you know, so things were either were fermented or pickled or tinned or, you know. And so we just kind of started doing all of that stuff. And you said some statistics about how much each family in England wastes. But I mean, the statistics in the world and how much a third of all food grown never reaches the shop shelf. So at great cost to the earth, I'd really like to add. And so we just thought in a playful way that we would kind of start highlighting food waste. And we found that we really enjoyed it. And we found like so many delicious things. So it was just kind of like, instead of It's kind of like using either the whole vegetable. So if you have a beautiful cauliflower, I think we never think of the outer leaves, but actually they're probably the most delicious of all. So we'd blanch them and chop them and slow cook them, or blanch them and grill them. And we learned that we could remill all our bread that we make back to flour and use it for cakes. And we realized that from the coffee machine, all the milk that you waste every day when someone asks for a cappuccino and you need to fill it in a certain amount, and we'd gather that and we'd make into yogurt and lovenies. And so we just kind of went on our own personal kind of journey. And I think it's just sort of, I realize that I have people around me in a kind of kitchen where we can do probably more things than the average house could do. But I think one of the key things is when you see the food waste, it is about shopping little and often and thinking, planning menus, thinking what you want to eat. It's not being sort of seduced by the 2-in-1 deals or the kind of, you know, the way often supermarkets are set up, are like they're like a market when you walk in, or the smell of baking, and you kind of spend a lot of money on food that you don't really need. And it's just, I think that it's more about planning. And I think also, I know this sounds really silly, but like to begin to have huge gratitude around food and the bounty of the earth. You know, I often think that people used to sit down and say grace, say, you know, are thankful for the food that they would receive. They understood the value of it. And I think we don't value food. We just expect it to be there, and we expect it to be there at a pretty low price.
I want to ask you a question around the move towards plant-based diets and the kind of general thrust for reasons of sustainability, largely in addition to kind of animal rights, a sort of just a move to this way of eating. A, what are your views on that? And B, do you think that it makes the lives of chefs easier or harder, inspires them to be more creative, gives you more options? I'd love to get your views on this.
Firstly, I think there's no doubt that eating mainly a largely plant-based diet is definitely very good for you and very nutritious. Having said that, I would definitely never want to rule out all the other things. I've seen that trend of a lot of dietary requirements and people eating in very particular ways in restaurants is, I personally don't find it creative. I find it incredibly restrictive. You know, you have a vision of how a dish would be, and then people want to come in, they want to modify things and change it. And that's a bit like someone coming in and kind of recreating your painting in a way. And sometimes that you sort of put something on a dish because you think it has value and it has a place there, and you've thought it through. I feel in many ways, if I'm really honest, that the world has a kind of collective eating disorder. You know, I think that there's so many emotions around food now, when people sort of, instead of what I was just talking about before of gratitude for the bounty of the earth, it's a sort of like, is this good for me? How many calories has it got? Has it got gluten in it? Is it dairy? We've kind of gone a little bit mad. I think we all know what is largely good for us. It's plants and grains, really. But it's the question that nobody ever really asks, which I always find extraordinary. I personally think the only question you do need to ask is, where does my food come from? So in terms of eating meat, for example, there's no doubt that those kind of huge, vast feedlots that are all over the world are really, really bad for the environment and the planet. But really beautiful small dairy farms are actually, you know, with good husbandry and good management of the land and the earth and a small herd, are actually carbon sequesters. So they're actually good for the environment. There's also a lot of, you know, that kind of demand now for all the kind of nut milks, goji, chia, you know. I mean, there's also implications to the planet of soy-based foods. And I mean, my solution is, I think it's really simple, is like, where does my food come from? Is it grown in good, clean soil? Is it good husbandry? And then I think everything is good for you. I genuinely do. And so I get like, I think we're all mashed up and confused about it. I think everybody's got very good intentions, but I think there's a lack of real understanding. We have to think about food in smaller ways and how we can reintroduce the nutrients and the goodness back into a very depleted earth and soil.
sustainability has become, dare I say it, a bit of a buzzword in the restaurant industry.
Yeah.
And from where you sit, are you seeing genuine, lasting, positive change? Or is there a bit of a danger of there being greenwashing and a little bit of sort of cosmetic but not real change within the industry?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the latter. I would say there's a lot of greenwashing, and I think there's a lot of buzzwords that people use. I think it's so important. I mean, it's the only thing I can say is it's so important to put your money where your mouth is and to be authentic. I don't see any real change in the way restaurants shop or their commitment to small farms or, there's certain words like hyper-seasonal or sustainable, or, I mean, I don't think there's a chef around that if you said to them, how do they cook? They go, oh, I cook seasonally, sustainably. I think that's just what people say. But I think actually, are you really buying from small farms? Are you really, I think one of the things is that it's very hard for chefs to make more than a kind of statement, because we don't really value the true cost of food. Until we really do really, really understand what it costs to grow good, good nutrient dense food, I don't think any change will come. I mean, I'm not sure of the statistic completely, but certainly in the kind of 40s, maybe early 50s, people would spend almost a third of their income on food. We spend a very small percentage of our monthly income on food. We choose to spend a lot more on probably our iPhone or a new set of trainers. I mean, do you know what I mean? We just don't prioritize the true cost of food. But if you could stand in a farm and you could see what it's really like to propagate a seed, to put it in a tiny little pot in a glasshouse, to water it and nurture it, like feed it like a little child. When it's strong and ready, it goes outside, and then you water it and you weed it and you water it and you weed it, and then you harvest and you transport it. I mean, and then we only want to pay £3 for 300 grams of strawberries, which is probably, if you really break it down to what that, it's absolutely nothing. And so I think we really just have to realize like what the true cost of food is and be a little bit more willing to pay it. And I know that you'll probably come back to the argument, but what about people who don't really have any money? But you can, and I've kind of pondered that for so long, but I really do believe that you can eat well for not very much money. Food doesn't have to cost a fortune. You can eat incredibly well, thoughtfully and carefully, but it does require care and consideration.
So speaking of cost and how much we value food and indeed how much it costs, how do you think the food and restaurant industry will have to respond to the coronavirus pandemic, and how will it have to rebuild? And do you think there may be some positives that emerge from this enormously difficult and challenging circumstance?
I want to be optimistic. I think for us, it has been, I think for the hospitality industry, it has been really cataclysmic what's happened, because we had an industry that really shut down overnight, and there's nothing, we can't do anything virtually. What we do is very physical, and it's very community based and interactive. If I'm being very honest with you, I can't, one of the hardest things that I've found during this whole period is we've been making decisions on shifting sand, and it's been very hard to see clearly. It's been a real struggle for me actually to see clearly through this. I think we have to be agile. I think everyone's tried to do different things. I mean, certainly for me working in central London, I think I don't know how the industry will rebound. I don't know if people are going to come back to work in offices. I don't know if people are going to come back to galleries, if tourists are going to come back to London, if people want to come into central London. I mean, it's so kind of reliant on lots of different things. And I think there will be a recovery, but how the next 18 months are going to look, I'm not sure.
So speaking of that, I mean, you know, the enormous stress and the disproportionate impact that the pandemic has had on the food industry and on restaurants. And you add on top of it the fact that professional kitchens are notoriously stressful, and in the past they've been infamous for bullying and other kinds of damaging behavior, and this kind of iconic image of a white-coated macho chef shouting at people who are his subordinates. What have you tried to do to create a more supportive and sustainable working culture in the restaurants that you've headed and founded?
I believe 100% that people work better if they're not fear-based. So I think that I know myself that if I'm in fear, my mind is a trap and I can't think creatively. So I think it's really important that a work environment is something that you enjoy. And especially in the restaurant industry, we spend probably, most of us do 60, 70 hours a week, every week. And we love it because it's what we do, but you have to look forward to coming to work. And I think I've worked really hard at trying to encourage women in the industry, because I think that we have a huge contribution to make. And I love a balanced kitchen. So I love working with both men and women. I think we all have different strengths and we work together. It's the kind of yin and yang. And I've really tried to keep shift patterns. So at Spring, you don't do more than 6 shifts a week. We have 2 days off. And I try to make it, for example, the scratch menu is not something that I write myself. I made the decision. So we do the food waste menu that you were asking about food waste before. We do a little menu every night. And we've done it since 2016, which is 5:30 and 6:30. You can come for £20. You have a 3-course meal. No choices, no dietaries, but it's just all based on food waste. But it's definitely not dumpster diving. It's kind of deliciousness is the benchmark. But I don't write. I give that to the younger chefs in the kitchen to write so they can have some creative freedom and expression. And it's really lovely to see what they come up with. And I think that I actually genuinely think that you couldn't afford to be the chef that you were talking about in this day and age anyway. I think there's way too much choice. I think kids are opinionated and they know how they want to be treated and they expect a kind of level of respect, which is amazing. And I think there were certainly before this, what happened this year, if you left Spring, you could have had a job somewhere else by the evening. You know, there was so much demand for chefs and the shortage has made a lot of people rethink.
So you have eliminated all single-use plastics from your kitchen in Spring as of 2019, and you've worked very closely with someone we've had on the podcast, Sean Sutherland, who's the founder of A Plastic Planet. How hard was that? Like, what steps did you have to take to achieve the milestone of removing single-use plastics from the kitchen?
So, that was a real penny drop moment for me, actually. I did a kind of talk on food waste somewhere, and Sean was talking. She was another speaker at the event that we were doing, and she talked about single-use plastic. I think now we have to look at all plastic. And I suddenly realized that the trouble is, I think, in terms of all the things that you ever want to discuss about anything, food, the environment, you can't think about any of them in isolation. So, but when I heard her speak, I felt so ashamed that I'd never actually kind of really given much thought to kind of plastic and devastating effect it has on the oceans and actually in the environment in general, also in the earth. And I actually asked Sean, who you mentioned before, if she would come and help us, because I really didn't know where to begin. And I felt completely overwhelmed. I remember going out everywhere, I just saw plastic. Every shop I went into, I just saw plastic. And actually, Sean was really brilliant. And she said, because I was like literally wringing my hands, you know, and she just said, just take 6 items. and see what you can do with like six items. And actually, she was brilliant. She came into the restaurant and we showed 20 minutes, the short version of The Plastic Ocean. I don't know if you've seen that documentary. And then we brought everybody into the restaurant on a Sunday and we all brainstormed together. I think what was really important was that we as a team were on board. It wasn't just kind of me coming into work and going, guys, we're getting used to rid of no more plastic in the kitchen. It was just, we all had to understand the impact on the planet and we all together as a group of people needed to make a commitment to try and do something about it. And that was, I think, the single most important thing that I did was that we were like, okay, like as a team, we're going to all do this together. And so we took six items, I think, originally. And I think probably the biggest one was cling film. And the other thing that Sean showed, told us what to do, which was amazing, was to put stats around what we did. So we actually kind of went through all our kind of orders and we worked out how much cling film that we'd used throughout the previous year. And then different things, like we used to use these ice cream cups that I thought were paper, but they actually had a plastic film around them. And we'd gone through 30,000 of those and we worked out, we piled them up and we worked out that was twice to the size of the Shard, for example. So that we really kind of put it in our minds exactly how much plastic we could visualize it. And then we pretty well just went cold turkey on everything. So we haven't had cling film actually since January 2018, not 2019. So it's been just over 2 years. And actually, it's incredibly simple when you start. I mean, it sounds really silly, but the solution we had to cling film was kind of jars and lids for things, which we never really had. I don't know if you know how restaurant kitchens work, but they never sell lids for pots or pans or gastros or anything. It's all another price. So most restaurants just don't buy them because they're more expensive. And we just tackled it individually, you know, whether it was giving up pens and moving to pencils or, And so, and then I think the last thing that we really struggled with was J-cloths, which are the kind of things that we wipe everything down with. And that was the last thing we got rid of. And that was probably, we definitely did it over a period of a year. We didn't kind of go single-use plastic free just from one day to the next. We tackled it bit by bit.
So I want to ask you, if somebody's sitting at home and they just, you know, they've listened to this and they decide that they're going to shop a little more sensibly and go to farmers market and buy often and buy less and try and eliminate single-use plastics, what are the other things that you think you can do to build a more sustainable kitchen or adopt a more sustainable approach to food in your own home?
Yeah, well, I would definitely say sort of don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Don't kind of maybe do what I was just saying that I did in the beginning with the single, you know, kind of catastrophize the problem. So kind of try and look at it as I think definitely like living in the solution is a lot better than living in the problem. So like, probably like doing little things at a time. I mean, I've done like lots of little things over the years and almost assimilated them into my life before I move on and do something. So, I mean, for example, I haven't been to any kind of big shops or supermarkets for, I don't know, probably 8 or 9 years. I just don't go into them. I do actually order a veg box through the farm that I work with, or I'd go to farmers markets, or I'll go to a small greengrocer and buy in very small amounts on the way home. I have a fantastic store cupboard. I think that makes a huge difference. It's full of kind of things that I can make a meal with, whether it be pulses, grains, good olive oils, anchovies, garlic, you know, so I can make something delicious out of the kind of simplest things. But other things like starting a compost bin, for example, and that's just incredibly simple, you know, just any of your scraps and peelings. I've got a bin underneath my sink and then I just take it out. I've got a composter outside. It's very small. It's not a big deal. I've got a postage stamp garden, you know, or things like my thing was I like drinking sparkling water. And for ages, you know, I kind of like would buy and then I just changed it up and I bought a really nice soda stream and I just have tap water and it's just like little things at a time. You know, I bought in some beeswrap I mean, any contribution that anybody can make is a good thing. And I think if we all just did a little bit, it would make a tremendous amount of difference.
Well, I think that that's an extraordinary note to end on. It seems to me that your career is an ensemble of doing an accumulation of small things that have generated magical food in wonderful institutions while doing as little harm to the planet as we possibly can. So for that, we're all enormously grateful. I am with you with solidarity and strength in the months and years ahead, but I am certain that great institutions will always survive and thrive, and you will be at the forefront of that. So thank you so much.
Thank you for talking to me.
Thank you for listening to Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. For more information on Coutts and their recommendations for a sustainable lifestyle, please visit coutts.com/conduitconversations. And for more information on the Conduit and our community of change makers, please visit theconduit.com.